Good morning, Mr. Walcott.
Good morning, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. Your Honor, I'm not sure how often this Court gets to see the participants below, but they're all here today, and with the Court's permission, I'd like to briefly introduce them. Behind me, seated on the behind the leather chairs, is the Caro family. Harvey Caro is the second one in from the left, and on the other side of the courtroom is Lloyd Arnold and Rodney Mitchell. I think it's helpful to have a face on a name. Your Honor, this case involves whether Harvey Caro, in 2003, a 70-year-old man, will be required to sell his family farm to Lloyd Arnold. It depends upon whether Mr. Arnold misled Mr. Caro in the negotiations regarding the farm of his intentions with respect to his ownership and the concomitant right of Mr. Caro to continue farming. If Mr. Caro had thought that Mr. Arnold would sell the farm, he would never have entered into the contract he did. I think an appeal like this, the first question is the scope of review by this court. There are two scopes of review. The first is whether the appeal is considered by this court de novo, and it is our suggestion that that is the general scope of review here. It's the whether the facts as found by Vice Chancellor Parsons arise to fraud in the inducement and would support rescission of the contract. The other scope, of course, is the factual appeal, the deference that this court gives to the facts as found by the court below. While Mr. Caro disputed some of the facts which the court found below, he does not contest them here, given the deference this court would show. But he does contest one set of facts, and that is the setting out of the facts relating to the Davis, Bowen, and Friedel work, which was done on the farm, and when that was begun, and also the relationship of that work to the proposed sale by Mr. Arnold to the Nature Conservancy, and how that fit in to the into what Mr. Arnold was thinking. Fraud in the inducement, of course, has been set out in many cases what is required for the proof. The first is that that Mr. Arnold made a false representation. And generally, the doctrine is a representation of fact. But, of course, it's clear that a representation of intention can arise to a fact if, at the time it was given, was not true or not intended to be followed through. The main case, I could not find a Supreme Court case on that, but there's a T.V. O'Toole case by then Judge Carey in the early 50s in which he clearly said that, and Vice Chancellor Parsons, of course, agreed with that. And so the question is, at the time the negotiations took place and Mr. Arnold said that you can farm as long as I own it, whether he intended at that time, given what the circumstances were, that Mr. Caro would continue to farm, that there were provisions in the sales agreement relating to his ability to farm, whether that statement, that you can continue to farm so long as I own it, whether that was false at the time it was made, because Mr. Arnold had no intention of owning the farm for any given period of time.
Let me just interrupt in terms of the facts here. Your client maintains that he never would have sold the farm if he had known that Mr. Arnold wasn't going to keep it indefinitely and therefore allow your client to continue to farm it, right?
That's correct.
And in terms of what the facts are, we have a statement by Mr. Arnold that you can stay here as long as I own it, which he admits he said and which the court found as a fact. We have no fact of Mr. Arnold then saying, and I intend to own this farm for a long time or indefinitely or for many years or something like that. So we don't have the second part of it. But then on top of that, we have, if I understand it correctly, your client's position being, I never would have sold if I had known, but no fact having been found by the trial court that your client advised Mr. Arnold, you realize that I want to be able to farm this for the rest of my life, so I'm assuming that after I sell it to you, you're going to keep this. So I guess what concerns me is that although your client may well have had that in mind, it does not appear that he expressed that intention that I don't want to sell unless I know that you're going to keep this land. And doesn't that impact whether there was a misrepresentation?
Well, Your Honor, I think the my answer to that is that any reasonable person would think that Mr. Arnold intended to own, even though he might not have said that I'm never going to sell the farm, and certainly Vice Chancellor Parsons found that he did not say that. But a reasonable person in Mr. Caro's position would believe that Mr. Arnold was going to own the farm for some reasonable period of time. And in fact, the discussions that took place at Mr. Book's office just prior to which Vice Chancellor Parsons quotes in his opinion, were discussions regarding the farm, and that the important thing that Mr. Caro had in mind was his ability to farm, and that Mr. Arnold said nothing will change for you, which certainly would lead a person to believe that Mr. Arnold didn't have a present intention of doing anything which would interrupt his ownership of the farm. And while Mr. Arnold didn't say, I'm not going to sell it for 5 years, 10 years, 3 years, or any period of time, and in fact, his position is that a piece of property is always for sale, that's not the tenor of the negotiations, and that's not certainly not what Mr. Book thought and not what Mr. Caro thought. So while there's no direct finding that Mr. Arnold was not going to sell the farm, there certainly was an implied an implication that he was not going to.
And Mr. Book's the accountant?
Yes. And then you look at the actual facts surrounding the April 28th signing, and you have three things that happen almost immediately which contradict the idea that one is going to own the farm for any period of time. The first one is that as soon as the ink is dry on the contract, this farm is subject to the partnership between Mr. Arnold and Mr. Mitchell. And that partnership provides that, and they have had other property under that partnership. And they're real estate developers, and that's what they do. And they said this farm came under that partnership. That partnership provides that the property is to be developed, and if there's not substantial development on that property, it's to be sold within 3 years.
Mr. Walcott,
yes.
I hesitate to interrupt this, but there's one point of clarification that may make it easier for me at least to focus on your arguments. If this were an appeal from a summary judgment, then the issue would be whether there's enough evidence in the record to create a tribal issue of fact. But we're beyond that. This is a post-trial adjudication. And so we not only, I gather, have to look at the facts, consider the facts that favor your client's side of the issue, but also the quantum of evidence. Isn't that correct?
I agree, Your Honor. I think
and if that's true, then don't we have to find that the undisputed facts, or at least the undisputed evidence, is not only not in equipoise but preponderates over the evidence adduced by the other side. in order to reach the result you're asking us to reach?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because we...
Let me...
Oh, I'm sorry.
If your client has the burden of proof, correct, of proving fraud and the inducement, burden of proof means that if the evidence is in equipoise, the party with the burden of proof loses. So the evidence can't just be in equipoise. It has to preponderate in favor of your side, does it not?
Yes, that's correct.
How do we then evaluate the facts as they were developed and articulated by the trial judge, given the type of review that we're required to make?
Well, I think the first thing the court should do is take a look at the facts as found by the court below, which was that Mr. Arnold said that you can farm so long as I own it. The negotiations before the sale, which included statements by Mr. Arnold, which he agrees to, that nothing would change at Mr. Book's office, the fact that Mr. Caro didn't sell his farm equipment, he intended to be able to farm, looking at the points in the contract which show activity beyond some very short period of time into the years.
Okay, so there's some evidence that could be regarded as favoring your side.
Yes.
It doesn't preponderate, does it?
Well, I think the issue before the court is whether the facts, as those are found, as Vice Chancellor Parsons found them, arise to fraud in the inducement. Now,
well, as I understand your argument, a large part of it depends on the fact that this agreement existed between Arnold and Mitchell. So when these statements were being made to your client, there was already an agreement in place where the land was either going to be developed or sold within 3 years after the contract was signed.
That's correct.
So to suggest that there was some indefinite period is what you're arguing was not simply misleading but fraud.
That's correct, Your Honor. And not only that, but you have the activity with Davis Bowen and Friedel, which took place on the day the contract was signed, that Mr. Mitchell called, because he was a partner with Mr. Arnold, called Davis Bowen and Friedel to get surveying work done immediately at the farm, which could only be used for a transfer of some sort of the farm. And then you have the activity with respect to seeing whether the state would trade property at Seven Hickories for this farm, because some property at Seven Hickories was something that Mr. Arnold and Mr. Mitchell were interested in. So they
how do we deal with the part of the Court of Chancery opinion where the Vice Chancellor mentions that your client chose to go to an accountant rather than a lawyer, and notwithstanding the fact that he chose an accountant, he did make some changes where he had substantial concerns and yet didn't make the changes to protect against what we're now dealing with in this appeal?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that the reason that he didn't make the changes, he didn't say to Mr. Arnold, well, you're going to own this farm for 10 years, was that he seemed assured that that wasn't going to be a problem, that it was not going to be sold, except for maybe the reasons that even Mr. Schwartz in the answering brief points out could have happened, a wife getting divorced, the death, or creditors foreclosing. So those sorts of things, yes, they might have entered into his mind and said, well, nothing, we can't do anything about that.
But you go back to your point is that your client never knew the outside limit was 3 years.
Right, and he never knew that they were immediately undertaking activity with respect to selling the farm.
Aren't there provisions in the contract itself that the trial court relied upon in saying that it's unfortunate that your client had a misunderstanding here, but the document itself talks about him getting a 1 acre or one lot of the subdivided property fee simple, or alternatively keeping the farmhouse and certain amount of land around the farmhouse. On its face, that indicates an intention to subdivide, doesn't it?
It certainly, yeah, and maybe that's the reason why there was subdivision permission in the contract. But it also, it's only that particular provision was just so he could move from the house he lived in to another spot on the property in the event the whole property was sold. And, of course, that was all done at the time he believed that the farm was going to be owned by Mr. Arnold. And if he decided to give up farming, he thought that he would just be able to move to another spot. And they wanted to make a hunting farm out of it so the farmhouse could be converted into a hunting farm. Something like that. I don't know, there was no evidence about that, but that certainly would be something that would be reasonable.
You're into the time you reserved. You can continue, but I just wanted you to be aware of that.
Well, I just wanted the other point that the vice chancellor found was that Mr. Caro's reliance, because of the as long as I own it language, was unreasonable, is something when you look at the provisions in the contract and you look at the assurances, the provisions meaning the farming, et cetera, that go out into the years, his reliance is not unreasonable. And I think that when Mr. Arnold assured him that nothing would change, that it's not unreasonable for him to do what he did. The rule should not be you have to go see a lawyer to protect yourself. The rule should be that people who are negotiating should put in the contract and not mislead people. And I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning. How are you, Mr. Schwartz?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, the opposing counsel was kind enough to introduce my clients. I'd just like to identify Mr. Arnold, the senior gentleman in the back, and Mr. Mitchell, his partner, sitting next to him. In his reply brief, Mr. Caro goes to this issue of the scope of review and his attempt to invite the court to do a de novo review of the action by the court below. He wrote at the beginning of the argument in the reply brief, Arnold is missing the main thrust of Caro's arguments on appeal. In keeping with the standard on appeal, Caro does not contest most of the material facts found by the court below. Rather, Caro contests the ultimate conclusion of the court. That conclusion is a legal determination and reviewable de novo, and he cites the DCV Holdings case.
Well, let's start with the facts. And do you agree that at the entire time Mr. Caro and Mr. Arnold were negotiating that Mr. Arnold had an agreement with Mr. Mitchell that this land would be subject to and that the outside limit before the land would be developed or sold would be 3 years?
No, I think the agreement provided that if it were not developed within 3 years, either of them could compel it to be sold.
So stated in another way, given your response, during the entire negotiations, there was an agreement that provided for the development of the farm as opposed to continuing to farm it.
Except that this farm was not bought for development. So although the agreement that had been entered into between Mr. Arnold and Mr. First of all, the agreement that was entered into between Mr. Arnold and Mr. Mitchell was entered into, as I recall, later than this transaction.
So the property was not subject to the agreement between Mr. Arnold and Mr. Mitchell?
Afterwards that, see, the way it started out.
It either was or it wasn't subject to that agreement.
Well, the agreement, the contract that's referred to by Mr. Walcott, I do not believe was in existence. I believe that the contract is dated later. But at the time the Caro farm was purchased, they had a general understanding that they were going to acquire property together, although it might be titled in both names. It might be titled just in Mr. Arnold's name. This one was going to be titled in Mr. Arnold's name. And there wasn't too much rhyme nor reason to that. They hadn't gotten it to the point where they had a contract until later.
When you say a contract, you mean a contract to buy the property or an agreement between the two partners?
No.
What we're talking about is an agreement between the two partners that if either or both of them bought property, that property would be either sold or developed within 3 years unless the partners agreed otherwise. Now, was there an agreement to that effect? And if there was, did it apply to this property?
I should have the answer to that at the tip of my fingers, Your Honor, and I apologize. I really don't want to misstate it.
Mr. Walcott has told us unequivocally, I assume, based on some evidence in the record, that the agreement between Mr. Arnold and Mr. Mitchell was in existence prior to the execution of the Caro contract. And that upon execution of the Caro contract, it became subject to the Mitchell-Arnold agreement. Is that in the record?
I believe what's in the record was that the parties agreed that the terms of that agreement would govern the Caro farm.
All right, so let's just leave it at that. Then we have a situation where Mr. Arnold is talking to Mr. Mitchell about whatever their arrangements are going to be. At the same time, he's negotiating to buy the Caro farm. And the Caro position is that the statements made to Mr. Caro were inconsistent with the arrangements being made between Mr. Arnold and Mr. Mitchell. Does the record support that conclusion?
No. It doesn't support that conclusion because the conclusion is based on the premise that the representations to Mr. Caro could not be carried out if the property was sold. Mr. Caro's entire argument is based upon the concept that a sale of the property would take away from Mr. Caro his rights, his contractual rights to farm it and to live on it, and that's simply not the case. The finding by the court below was that when Mr. Arnold told Mr. Caro that nothing would change for him, that he meant it. And in fact, when they went to negotiate a sale of the Caro farm to the Nature Conservancy, Mr. Arnold improved Mr. Caro's position by negotiating terms that would allow him to farm it for the rest of his life. So there's no conflict between a sale of the property and the representations that were made to Mr. Caro. That's the logical fallacy, I believe, in Mr. Caro's whole argument.
So then this entire case could end if we simply reform the contract by adding a provision that says Mr. Caro can farm this as long as he lives, and apparently everybody would be happy with that.
I presume that's the case.
I'm confused. You're saying that your client would be satisfied with a reformation of this agreement that provides for Mr. Caro to be able to farm the land for the rest of his life?
I've not consulted with my client, and I'm reluctant to
right.
advise the court without getting my client's consent. My understanding, I mean, I think I'd have to talk to my client if the court is considering a reformation, but wants to know my client's position on that. That's not something I prepared in advance. It's not something I foresaw.
Well, you can speak about it later. In any case, we want to be sure that we understand the facts and then apply the law to the facts as we understand them. And obviously the purpose of the court's questions here is to narrow down the area of dispute between the parties based on the record. And it seems that Mr. Caro's overriding concern is he get the farm it for the rest of his life, and that this contract doesn't guarantee that to the extent it's not a provision that would be incorporated in a deed. But if your clients are content to have him farm it for the rest of his life, then maybe the parties are more in agreement than we were led to believe when we read the brief.
My client negotiated a contract with Mr. Caro and with his accountant, and it provided that as long as my client was in agreement to rent it out to anybody, it would be rented to Mr. Caro at $75 an acre.
Sure, but that's a lot different than saying Mr. Caro can farm it as long as he lives. Your client also said, as long as I own it, nothing for you is going to change. Well, clearly, if it was sold, things do change. You can no longer rent it maybe at $75. But if Mr. Caro gets a life estate, then Mr. Caro is completely protected. I mean, a life right to farm it.
Well, I'm reluctant to...
I'm not trying to change the nature of this particular case. I'm just trying to understand the fraud in the inducement part of the case we have. And there seems to be a suggestion that Mr. Caro could farm this indefinitely, if not for the rest of his life. You're telling me that was your client's intention when he said that.
That's right.
However, it's not reflected in the contract as precisely as we're doing it right now.
It's not reflected in the contract at all.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I agree. And the question then is, was there fraud? And the finding of the court below is that there was no fraud, because when my client represented to Mr. Caro that nothing was going to change for him, he meant it.
Well, let me try and go at this a little bit differently. The trial court seems to have found that there was a partnership agreement and that it did require your client to and his partner to sell any new parcel within 3 years of its purchase unless both parties agreed to retain it for a longer period. That's at page 2.
Mm-hmm.
So let's assume for a moment that the court found, as a matter of fact, that there was this agreement.
Yeah.
If I understand what you're saying, well, even though there was this agreement, that doesn't mean that what Mr. Arnold said to Mr. Caro was wrong, because selling the property, Mr. Arnold and his partner selling the property within 3 years, wouldn't have to affect Mr. Caro's interest in staying on the property and being able to farm it.
That's right? Our argument, yes.
Okay. And you find support for that in the fact that there were some negotiations to sell this property to the Conservancy, and if that deal had gone through, it would have included a provision to protect Mr. Caro, right?
Yes.
Okay. But that didn't happen.
Yes.
So where are we now? You know, has the property, or is the property under contract to be sold by your clients to somebody else or to be developed by your clients? I'm having trouble because there seems to be an inconsistency between the way you're presenting the facts to this court as kind of, hey, there's no problem here because what my client said to Mr. Caro is correct. And yet Mr. Caro's taking the approach of, I've been thrown off the property and it's no longer mine to farm at all. Now, what is it?
Mr. Caro is on the farm. He's farming it, and he's going to continue to farm it. my client, there is no contract for the sale of the property to any other party, and the only thing pending is this litigation concerning the farm. I take it, and there's an agreement between Mr. Caro and Mr. Arnold, so that if this case were to be resolved unfavorably to Mr. Caro, he would be able to continue at a minimum to farm the farm through the end of the growing crop. He's not going to he needed that in order to be able to plant his seed this year, and we cooperated. And so, I mean, he has his rights under the contract. The contract was negotiated for. The terms are binding upon my client if the contract's not rescinded. And the contract was found not to be fraudulent, not to be the product of fraud exercised on Mr. Caro by Mr. Arnold. So, I mean, I'm not sure where that leaves us with regard to your question.
Well, my concern is that if Mr. Caro was told, you're going to be able to farm this land for the rest of your life if that's what you want to do, and he signs a contract based upon that representation, and that representation was false because the property was going to be developed or sold, then that's one set of facts. If he was told, you're going to be able to farm this land for the rest of your life if you want, and that continues to be an accurate statement, and there is nothing that is going to prevent him from farming it for the rest of his life, then we've got a different set of facts and a different, perhaps, analysis of whether there was a misrepresentation that was made.
Well, Mr. Caro might not farm it because Mr. Arnold doesn't want it farmed in a given year. That was expressly in the contract and negotiated for. Mr. Caro gave up the right to insist on farming it in exchange for capping the rental at $75 per acre.
Okay, but that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is whether Mr. Arnold is free to either develop the property or sell it and give and terminate Mr. Caro's right to be able to farm it.
As a practical matter, the farm is not developable. It's outside the growth zone. It is the current requirements in Kent County are 10 acres per site in that part of the county. It's just not a practical. There's
but,
no
but
water and sewer.
But you're not answering my question, really.
No, I'm sorry.
The question was, is the representation, or at least arguably the representation was made, Mr. Caro, you will be able to farm this land for the rest of your life if you want to, subject to this provision about in any given year I might say don't farm it, right?
Not exactly. The representation that Your Honor is referring to is one that was made at the first meeting. As the court below noted, the contract was negotiated over a short period of time, but the initial proposal developed across the table with Mr. Book and Mr. Caro to the point where Mr. Caro would be permitted to farm it if Mr. Arnold agreed, desired to rent it out. So his insistence, Mr. Caro's insistence, that it was terribly important to me that I would have the right to farm it for the rest of my life, I think rings hollow because he negotiated away that right in exchange for a $75 an acre cap.
So your understanding is Mr. Caro negotiated an agreement that said if anybody farms it, I want to be the one farming it at $75 an acre.
Exactly.
If nobody farms it, nobody farms it.
That's the contract. It was negotiated. And that clearly is a change from what Mr. Arnold said at their first meeting. It represents a development of the proposals as they migrated toward the final form of written contract.
So your position is anyone who read the contract, including Mr. Caro, would be on notice that you're not going to be able to farm this indefinitely because we may no longer decide to farm it. But to the extent we decide to let anyone farm it, it will be you, and it will be at $75 an acre. But there's no promise to you that you're going to get to farm it year to year. That's what's in the
contract. That's what the contract says.
And is that inconsistent anyway with any oral conversations?
I think so. I think it's probably inconsistent with what Mr. Arnold said. At the time the contract was signed, when he said, Harvey, nothing's going to change for you.
And your position is when you see something in writing that's significantly inconsistent with some oral statement, it's incumbent upon Mr. Caro to say, well, wait a minute, this isn't our understanding. Or are you telling me there was a renegotiation and what's in writing is the renegotiation?
What's in writing is an enforceable contract, and what Mr. Arnold told Mr. Caro is what he intended to make happen.
Yes, and but when Mr. Arnold handed the draft contract to Mr. Caro, did he say, by the way, Mr. Caro, there's at least one change in this contract or this proposed contract that's different from what I told you 2 weeks ago?
It wasn't in it at that point. He handed him the draft contract, and then about a week later, they met in Mr. Book's office. And the change that we're just talking about now was discussed and negotiated and added by pencil. Mr. Book, the accountant, actually wrote that in by hand.
Your time is up, Mr. Schwartz.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
Three minutes and 15 seconds. No, I just wanted to clear the record up with respect to the partnership agreement between Mr. Arnold and Mr. Mitchell. It is PX-17, which is found at the Appendix A-567, and it's dated July 30th, 2002, which is obviously before the date of the contract for the sale of the farm. And the discussion of it in the record at the trial can be found that A-153 and some pages before that and some pages after that, which they discussed their agreement. With respect to the Nature Conservancy negotiation, and that shows Mr. Arnold of good intentions, but that, of course, comes after the time Mr. Caro saw Mr. Arnold at the farm and said, I want out of this, because he had seen the Davis-Bowen people there and they were surveying. And he said, it looks like you're going to develop the farm. Let me out. So after that, Mr. Arnold definitely was on notice that Mr. Caro was watching what was going on. And, of course, he would try to negotiate some deal so that he could.
What does Mr. Caro want in the contract that's not in the contract?
Well, Your Honor, I think first he wanted the opportunity to farm for the rest of his life. But he also also thought he was going to be dealing with Mr. Arnold and not with anyone else, certainly not with Mr. Mitchell. And so there was so that would be.
How is that relevant if he gets the farm for the rest of his life?
Well, because there would be a landlord, and if the contract is enforced, it does provide that in terms of Mr. Carroll being able to farm, it says that if Mr. Arnold decides to use the farm for hunting purposes, then Mr. Carroll might not be able to farm. I think there has to be a use put to the farm, and it may be that if there's another owner, they may decide to use it as a hunting farm, use the whole thing as a hunting farm, and I don't know that that was the understanding that the parties had at the beginning. There might be a little bit of area, and Mr. Carroll would continue to farm. But I think that he would, the important part is that even if, you know, the court were to reform the contract, that at the beginning he would never have entered into it if he thought there was going to be some disruption of his ability to farm, as he thought it was going to happen through the years that he has remaining to farm. And whether it's practical or not to sell the farm for development, it certainly is practical to sell it to someone else for a tax deduction, if that's what they are going to do, or to sell. It's right next to Bombay Hook. There are a lot of opportunities for the sale of the farm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court appreciates your arguments and your briefing in this matter. The court will take this case under advisement, as we normally do, and will be very happy to render a decision. Based on the arguments today, the court would encourage you to confer with one another. And after you've had an opportunity to confer, if you still want the court to decide the case, we'd like you both to write to the court in 2 weeks. And if you've reached a resolution independent of the court, then there will be no need for us to render an opinion. But as I say, the court is very happy to decide this case and issue an opinion. But based on the argument, it seems that it might be productive for you to talk to each other over the next 2 weeks. So the court will look to hear from each of you in the next 2 weeks, and at the end of 2 weeks, you'll either say, we've resolved the matter based on our consultation, or we'd like the court to render a decision. The court will now take a brief recess.